We're continuing with how to study the Bible. I hope you're enjoying it and maybe looking at the Bible in a little different light. And of course, we've been spending a great deal of time on figurative language, and we may get done with that part tonight. I don't know. There's a few more types that I want to talk about that are used a great deal in the Bible. The first one I want to talk about is personification. Personification. And that's where inanimate objects are given attributes of living things. And this is a very common figure of speech. Notice he didn't start that until I started talking. It was simultaneous. I mean, it was just perfect. That's funny. Let's begin with Isaiah 55:12. Isaiah 55:12. We could literally spend the whole time period just looking at personification. It's that common. Isaiah 55:12. Says, "For you shall go out with joy and be led out with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth into singing before you, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands." There is about the best example of personification you can find. Hills, of course, are inanimate. They're not living, but yet they're given qualities or attributes of something that is living. Another, it says that they would break forth into singing. Well, we know that hills can't sing like we sing. And the same way with the trees of the field clapping their hands. Well, they can't clap their hands. But what is he, by using that figure of speech, what's he emphasizing in the verse? Why use personification here? And you know, a lot of times figures of speech are used to emphasize something. Cause it to be something that you can remember. So what's he doing in this verse? By using the mountains of the hills shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. What's he?
It's like nature is rejoicing.
Nature is rejoicing. Yeah, it is such a broad, wonderful joy that even these inanimate objects are rejoicing. That's how great a joy it is.
From verse 11. Yes.
Yes. When that God's word. Yeah, that's right. All right. We'll look at just a few more. Let's see. I'm going to look at a couple in the New Testament. Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Would someone read verse 34, the last verse in that chapter?
"Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof."
Okay, now why is that one included under personification? What inanimate object is being given an attribute of a living thing? Okay, time, tomorrow in particular. Tomorrow can't really worry, can it? I mean, not literally worry, but why is he using that phrase? Why is he saying tomorrow will worry about itself? What's he trying to say in a way that's going to emphasize the idea about not worrying? Okay. We've got plenty for today. We don't have to look at tomorrow's. You might say, let tomorrow take care of itself. And again, that's a figure of speech because tomorrow doesn't have anything to take care of. Right? It's just time. But that's a way that emphasizes don't bring tomorrow's worries into today. But it's a great way to say it. It's a way to remember it. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 is another example of this. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. This is a very obvious one. Verses 15 and 16, someone, please.
If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not one of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body?
Okay. Feet and ears don't talk. All right? I mean, they don't have any sort of mouth to talk with. But why is he using that figure of speech in this context?
The body isn't just one thing. It's made up of many.
And what's he alluding to in... Yeah, that's right. See, he's taken the human body, and we know that a foot or an ear can't talk, but the thing he's emphasizing is that just like the body's made up of all kinds of parts and they're all important, so is the church. But what a great way to say that. What a great way to remember it. And it is a way to remember it. You know, you think a foot's talking? Wow. Well, but that it helps you remember it and it emphasizes it. And in some ways it even clarifies it. Okay, one more before we move on. This is in Leviticus. Leviticus 18. Verse 25, somebody please. Leviticus chapter 18, verse 25.
For the land has become defiled. Therefore I have brought its punishment upon it. So the land has spewed out its habitations.
Okay, the land spews out, or New King James says vomits out the people. Well, that's a pretty expressive way of saying what? What's he saying in this section? Go back and look at verse 24. Do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. So when he talks about the land vomiting its inhabitants, he's talking about God casting those people out who are heathen, pagans, who are against him, however we might want to put that. But that's a great way of saying that. And you know, that's what great writers do. They write things in ways that clarify, they write ways in such a way that causes you to remember it or emphasizes some detail. And the Bible is the greatest literature, so we would expect great writing in the Bible because it has the greatest author, so it's going to have the greatest writing. All right, let's look at paronomasia. That's a real common one. Yeah, it's not really that common, but Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. I'm sorry, it's Matthew chapter 8. Wrong chapter. Matthew chapter 8. This is kind of a play upon words. It's kind of the way it's used. Matthew chapter 8, verse 22. Someone please. Matthew chapter 8, verse 22. Okay, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. All right, and that's what this type of figure of speech is. It's where the word dead or any word can be repeated in a phrase or in a statement where it's kind of a play upon the words. All right, obviously. Physically dead people can't bury physically dead people. We know that. All right, that's impossible. So he's using it in slightly different ways to use it kind of as a play upon words, which is, again, kind of a way of remembering it, but also a way of emphasizing it, because the context is talking about being a disciple of Jesus and what it cost. We go up a couple of verses. Of verse 19, a certain scribe came and said to him, "Teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Then another of his disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." And some people, because they didn't realize the figure of speech that he's using, coupled with first century burial practices, made it sound like Jesus was harsh and uncaring. And of course, that's the furthest thing from what Jesus would ever be. Because they had vastly different burial practices than we did. You know, their burial practices at the first century, during Jesus' time in particular, a full burial would take an entire year from start to finish. Okay, but again, they didn't bury people like we buried them. And so that alone caused a lot of difference. There were like three different time periods during that course of the year. And if you, you know, if you read the headlines, I don't know how many months ago, and you heard about the James ossuary box. Well, that's a box, yay by yay by yay. Those aren't technical terms. That would have the bones in it. But when they first put the person wherever it was they were buried, of course, it wasn't just bones. So there was a process of deterioration that took place, and those stages were all part of first century burial practices to the end where the bones were collected and like put in one of those ossuary boxes. So without knowing all that, you could come up and say, "Boy, Jesus was really being harsh. Why wouldn't he let him go bury his father?" Well, that's the reason, because it was a vastly different type of burial practice. And probably in this case, the guy had probably been dead for many months before this even took place. So, again, knowing those things helps you understand Jesus' response. Because without knowing that, you could come up with the wrong idea. Another one that's used quite a bit, anthropomorphism, where a figure is ascribed human features or elements of the human form to God. In other words, God is given these features of man. And of course, God does that to help us understand God. And we'll look at a few of those. Let's go to 1 Peter 3:12. 1 Peter 3, verse 12. And if you get there, just please go ahead and read that for us.
"For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil."
I thought God was a spirit. And you're supposed to say, "Well, he is." He doesn't have a physical body with physical ears or physical eyes or a physical face. Well, then why, this is a quote from the Old Testament, I think it's from one of the Psalms, why does the psalmist in this case give human forms, features to God? What's the point? What's the purpose? That's right, because we have eyes and we know what they do, and we have ears and we know what they do. And so it helps us understand God. Yeah, God doesn't have a physical form with a physical face, but by attributing him these features, it helps us understand God in a much better way. Now let's do one more example of that. Exodus 33, this one I know you'll remember. Exodus 33. And verses 22 and 23. This is where Moses meets God, in a sense. That's why these terms are used. Verses 23,
22
and 23 of Exodus 33.
"So it shall be while my glory passes by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand, and you will see my back, but my face shall not be seen.
Okay, see all those characteristics he uses there? Well, he doesn't have a physical hand that he covers him up, or a physical back. God doesn't have really God doesn't have a physical back and front, or a physical back and a physical face. But it's very useful in this case to describe what Moses is going to experience. Because Moses, just like us, we can't really understand what a purely spirit being is. And the reason for that is because we're physical. You know, we have a physical form, and that's mainly how we think, isn't it? So the Holy Spirit uses these type of terms and gives features to God to, again, to help us understand better. All right, prolepsis. This is one that has been, oh my, if people would have understood prolepsis, well, and if they would now, they wouldn't have made so many false statements about prophecy. This has a lot to do with prophecies. Prolepsis is an... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. P-R-O. This is one of those, you can spell it phonetically. P-R-O-L-E-P-S-I-S. Prolepsis. It's an anticipating, especially the describing of something before it has been done, as if it was already done. See, that's why it has a lot to do with prophecy. A lot of times in the Bible, the Bible will say something has been done, spoken of as being done, when it's not done yet. The reason for that is to emphasize the fact that God has said it will be done, and nothing can change it. And that's called prolepsis. So let's look at an example of some of these. First of all, let's go to Genesis 12. This is about Abraham. And there's lots of these in the Old Testament. Genesis chapter 12. And first of all, verse 8. Would someone read verse 8? Genesis 12, verse 8, and then we'll go to Genesis 28. Okay? Genesis 12, verse 8. Would someone read that, please?
And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent at Bethel on the west, and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord.
All right. Now, people that don't believe in the Bible, they're going to say, aha, there's a mistake. There was no Bethel at this time, which is true. There wasn't. There wasn't a Bethel at this time. So why does he call it Bethel? Well, let's go to Genesis chapter 28. And let's see. Verse 19. Genesis 28, verse 19 says this. And he called, this is Jacob, and he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city had been Luz previously. It wasn't named until Genesis chapter 28. But it's spoken of as being in existence in Genesis chapter 12, because that's what it was going to be called, was Bethel. In Genesis chapter 12, at the time of Abraham, it was called Luz. But he calls it Bethel because that's what it's going to be called by Jacob in Genesis chapter 28. And this is done lots of times in the Old Testament. But what happens is people that want to try and find mistakes in the Bible, these are the type of things they go to. And this is done, this is even done in common reporting and in book writing and stuff today. This isn't something just from the Bible. But that's what it's called. It's called prolepsis, where something is spoken of as existing before it actually did. Let's just do one more, and then we'll move on. One in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 10. verse 4, and then we'll go to Matthew 26. Matthew 10, verse 4. Verse 4 says, and this is a list of the 12 apostles, one of the list. Verse 4 says, Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. Had Judas betrayed him in Matthew chapter 10? No, hadn't betrayed him yet, but he was going to. So it's so the Bible, God, the author of it, knew what was going to happen. And so it's spoken of in the past tense, even though it's going to happen in the future. And it's so common that it's given the name prolepsis, because it happens over and over and over again. And then, of course, Matthew 26 is where Judas betrays him. But there's an instance, and again, it's used commonly throughout, especially in the Old Testament. It's very common. Okay, let's look at ellipsis. Matthew chapter 11, verse 18. So just a page or two over in your Bible. Ellipsis. E-L-L-I-P-S-I-S. This is where words are left out, but they're understood. You can't do that with freshmen, by the way. Just giving you a hint.
What was the reference?
Oh, the first one is Matthew 11, 18. You can't leave out words and assume freshmen know how to fill in the blanks. Doesn't happen. Rachel, you're not a freshman, are you? That's what I thought. Uh-oh. Giving Rachel a hard time. Matthew chapter 11, verse 18 says, For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. Now, I think John came eating and drinking. He did eat and drink some. But what's the context? Look at verse 19. The Son of Man came eating and drinking. They say, Look, a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, but wisdom is justified by her children. And if you look at that whole context, going all the way back up really to verse 1, which you don't have time to read the whole thing, what John did not do, which Jesus did, John accepted invitations to eat and drink. Jesus did. John did not, Jesus did. And that was the difference between them, and that's what the context is. So when we talk about ellipsis, words being left out, for John came neither eating nor drinking, declining invitations to eat. But that's not put in there. First of all, if you put it in there, it takes away from the account. But that's an example of words being left out. John did eat and drink, but he didn't accept invitations to go anywhere to eat and drink. And that's the difference. Jesus did. Jesus ate with publicans and sinners, right? Verse 19, he says he was a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So Jesus did go eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners. John didn't. And there was a difference between them. So words were left out. Okay, an idiom. A peculiar use of words or phrases. We have them here in Southwest Missouri. People have them all over the world. Idioms. Just phrases that are kind of unique to a certain location. And I'm sure you're already thinking of several in your mind.
I had a couple of friends. One of them was from northern Arkansas and one was from southern Missouri. And they talked for an hour about food they'd eaten. I had no idea what to say.
Okay. All right. And those are just everywhere, right? I mean, you go to any part of the country or world. You know, some people from the different parts of the world come here and we'll use phrases. They don't have any idea what we're talking about. Well, the Bible uses idioms because the Bible was written for common people. Just let's look at one real quick and then we'll move on. Acts chapter 2. Verse 46. So continuing daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart. I remember growing up listening to people talking about, well, it's time to break bread. I mean, it's time to eat. All right? Meaning it's time to eat. And they did that. People still break bread. They usually don't call it that very often. But there's also a different breaking of bread that the Bible talks about where it's alluding to the Lord's Supper. And those are two different instances. Two very different instances. So those are idioms. an apostrophe. 2 Samuel 18. An apostrophe is where you address an absent or imaginary person or thing. 2 Samuel 18. I'm just trying to get done so we're not using all these examples. But 2 Samuel 18. And would someone read verse 33? Verse 33 of 2 Samuel 18.
Then the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. Then he went, and as he went, he said thus, O my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. O Absalom, my son.
So there we see him essentially addressing Absalom, and of course Absalom's not there, right, because he's died. And that type is called an apostrophe, where you address someone who isn't there. They are absent. Interrogation. This isn't like the interrogation that we think about, but in some ways it's kind of similar because it's a strong way, usually in the form of a question, an interrogative, where you are emphasizing some really important truth. Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14 says this. This is this section talks about the difference between Christ and angels. Verse 14 says, are they not all, referring to angels, ministering spirits sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation? Well, that's an interrogative. That's an interrogation figure of speech. And it is a way, it's asking a question, but it's a question that's essentially answered. Yes, they are. Angels are ministering spirits who are sent forth to minister for those who will inherit salvation. And that's an important truth. And so it's put in that form, again, to emphasize it and to help people remember it. It's a way of writing, which the Bible uses on more than one occasion. Romans chapter 8. And that'll be about it for the night, looks like. Romans chapter 8. We'll begin reading in verse 33. Romans chapter 8, verse 33. Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It's Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who's even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Again, those are all of those interrogative statements. Those are questions. But the answer is implied. But it's a way of driving home the point that nothing can separate us from the love of God. By the way, I was reading this one of those greatly abused verses in the Bible that I was reading. I don't know if any of you know who Adrian Rogers is. He's probably the most well-known Baptist preacher in the country right now. He's preached in Memphis for... Oh my, he's been at the same church there in Memphis, I'm sure, for 40 years. But he's very well known in Southern Baptist. I was reading him today, and he said, this verse alone proves eternal security. He says, you don't have to have any other verses in the Bible. That's enough to prove eternal security, that there's no way you can lose salvation.